From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And you know, we always have some interesting topics to talk over. What's on the line this time?
Yes, we're going to talk about cannibal sandwiches. That's what they're called when people eat raw beef.
Okay.
And I certainly understand that because I had relatives who used to eat that all the time. And exercise boosting creativity. We're going to talk about another benefit of exercise. Great to think about this time of year because when the nights get long and the days get short, we tend to just do less.
You're going to hand it to the couch potatoes
one
more time.
One more time. Let's get rid of the couch potatoes.
What's our recipe?
Mocktails. So mocktails. So these are drinks without the alcohol.
Yeah, and I can see we have them right here, so we can do a little tasting.
We are.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. To the phones now, Zorba, and our first caller. We welcome a listener in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
I was wanting some advice in regards to trying to quit drinking soda. I've been a lifelong Dr. Pepper addict. No matter what I try to do, I can't seem to kick it.
Uh-huh. I love that question because I kind of would like to do that too.
Wait a minute, you drink soda a lot?
I tend to drink it once a day with lunch.
Now, wait a second. How much soda do you drink, caller?
I probably drink 10 sodas a day.
Oh, my goodness.
He drinks 10 sodas a day. You drink one soda a day. Tom thinks he wants to stop drinking his one soda a day. You would be happy if you only drank one soda a day, right?
Absolutely.
So you see, it's all relative.
Yeah, it is.
It's in the mind. 10 sodas a day is a lot. I mean, that is a lot of soda. So, I've got some ideas that you can actually do to try to reduce that. First of all, it becomes a compulsion. That's really what it is. You become used to something. It's a compulsion. Some people drink coffee. They'll drink 8 to 10 cups of coffee every day. So one of the things you want to do, because it's probably also related to the taste of Dr. Pepper, is initially I would recommend every other drink, you drink a Dr. Pepper, and then you drink water, which is either carbonated or not carbonated, and you'll probably like carbonated water better. And you do that every other time. And you may have to buy it and bring it at your desk because the freeness of it, the fact that it doesn't cost something, actually does make a difference. In other words, you go there and you get free Dr. Pepper and you don't like the taste of the diet drinks that are there, but you may have to bring in your own club soda to be able to do that. And that's what I would recommend. And that will begin to change your palate. Are you concerned because of the calories from it? Or are you concerned because of the caffeine in it? What bothers you the most about it?
I guess it would be, a lot of it's the sugar that's in it.
Right.
Yeah, it'd probably be the biggest thing.
Yeah, because if you're drinking 10 cans and each can is 12 ounces, you're getting 120 teaspoons of sugar into your body every day, roughly. And that is a lot of sugar. You'd never sit down at a sugar bowl. That's probably a sugar bowl full of sugar every single day. And you plot that out for the year, and it's too much for your pancreas, too much to produce insulin. But if you cut it down from 10 a day to 5 a day, you would be cutting out half the sugar. Then, once you're at 5 a day, you see whether or not you can cut it down further to 2 or 3 a day. There are medicines that actually help with this, and sometimes people will take this for 3 months. There's a drug called Wellbutrin or bupropion, and we use it for people who have compulsive behavior to quit smoking. And we've discovered that 90 days of bupropion, a medication, can actually help a great deal with compulsive behavior. So, although it wouldn't be my first step, my second step would be, if you go, I just can't do it, is I would consider being on the drug for 90 days. And then you've got to go through the behavioral change of actually cutting it in half, being stable on that, and then taking that and cutting it in half. Thank you so much for your call.
All right. Thank you.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, listener with us now in Brookfield, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba. Hello, Mr. Clark. I am a 78-year-old male, but young at heart and young at mind.
Good for you.
because it's my relationship with a young, beautiful young lady. She's 40 years younger than I am, and wow. for 15 years, and she keeps me going, I guess. I take 8 different pills every day for gout, blood pressure, prostate enlargement, cholesterol, and for irregular heartbeat. I drink hardly any water. I drink in the morning 3 cups of herbal tea and then more tea during the day, but I just don't drink water. I never did in my life. So I'm okay during the day, but I'm getting weak in the evening and I have a hard time getting up in the morning. I walk every evening 50 minutes, starting at 4 o'clock before I get too weak. In summer, I play golf. I have a resort on Washington Island, which I run, but I'm just have a hard time doing all those things. And I was wondering what you could recommend what I should do.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the water thing. You don't have to drink water. You're drinking tea. Tea is fine. Tea is flavored water. We're flavoring it with tea leaves. And, you know, and okay. that's perfectly fine. Getting to the exercise is fine. But now let's get to the 40, the person who's your relationship with the person 40 years younger. How long have you known her?
15 years.
15 years, so quite a long time. I think multi-generational relationships are super. And I find it incredibly important. And I think one of the problems that people have when they get older is they're not around people who are younger. Because frankly, people who are younger often have more energy than people who are...
Right.
Who are older.
So we should all ditch partners?
I didn't say we should ditch.
Go for youth?
No, wait a second. You're making an assumption. You're making an assumption that he ditched his partner and went for someone 40 years younger.
No, I didn't assume that. I'm saying for all the rest of us.
No, but I'm talking about relationships with being with people who are younger than you are. That's what I mean. So I love skiing with my kids who are much younger than I am, and I find that highly motivating. I don't like to exercise with people my age. I mean, like one or two, but if there are too many people my age, I don't feel the same way. So getting back to the energy issue, you say you don't have as much energy in the evening, meaning that you don't feel like you're doing as much?
Yes, and even sometimes during the day, I'm a windsurf on Lake Michigan, and then when I go up to my house up the hill, I have to sit down sometimes because I have no more pep.
Yeah. Did you say you windsurf on Lake Michigan?
Right.
So, and you're 80. 80
78.
And you windsurf. So I must tell you something. A 70-year-old who windsurfs on Lake Michigan, by definition, has lots of energy. So first of all, being tired after you windsurf on Lake Michigan, by definition, is exactly what your body is telling you. Now, I do have a recommendation, though. Do you ever nap in the middle of the day?
I do not.
That's
I used to.
That's what I recommend doing. Now, let me explain a bit about napping, because I think napping is actually very important, and I think it's very, very useful throughout the lifespan. 20 minutes, 30 minutes maximum, set a timer and don't be stuck on with the fact that you may not go to sleep. In other words, you may lay there and you may not go to sleep. You may just relax your body and not do anything. But 20 to 30 minutes in the middle of the day where you actually take a nap will give you more energy in the evening. If you do an hour, it will disturb your sleep. So I recommend getting a timer that you like. If you've got a smartphone, they have timer apps that are very useful. The one I happen to like is called Insight Timer. We'll put that on our website, zorbapastor.org. But I like the Insight Timer app. And the reason is it has a nice little ping, a nice little sound to it. And I nap whenever I can for 20 minutes in the middle of the day, and I have much more energy in the evening. So I would do that. But a windsurfer on Lake Michigan who gets tired after windsurfing and having a relationship with somebody 40 years younger, I think you've got lots of energy. You just make little changes. Thank you so much for your call, and thanks for sharing your story.
Keep it up. Now I'm tired. Can I take a nap?
Now you just said keep it up. Yes.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's talk about cannibal sandwiches.
Well, cannibal sandwiches were common when I was a kid, and I have to admit I have eaten them. I mean, that's what they're called. They're actually ground beef with onions on them with a little sometimes salt and pepper and other seasonings, and it's eating raw beef. And And I must admit, I've had them, and I must admit, sometimes when I make, not sometimes, most of the time when I'm making burgers in the summer around the house, which I will make on the barbecue,
You do that? You have one?
Yes. Oh. And I think I may actually stop doing it, but I do it. And my kids look and they go, how can you do that? And I said, I don't know. My mom did it. My dad did it. And
I don't think it's as common now as it used to
be. Did you do it as a child?
No, I never have.
Really? Well, your mother never served you a sandwich? I have two of my favorite patients who were Navy nurses in World War II. One is 92 and the other was 94. And they were talking about the fact that that when they go to parties and stuff, and if they make a party at their house, they always have cannibal sandwiches. And I actually hadn't heard the term cannibal sandwiches, but that's what they would have. And they were kind of shy about admitting the fact that they did it. And I said, it's not healthy. And they said, oh, okay. And I knew right away this was not going to change their behavior at all because they've never gotten sick.
It isn't healthy. But a lot of things we do aren't healthy. Yeah, let's talk about this.
There were four cases recently in Wisconsin, and basically this was an outbreak of E. coli tied to cannibal sandwiches, tied to raw corned beef, raw beef. Yeah. And it turns out it is an issue because E. coli can infect you can actually cause severe diarrhea, severe cramping, and can actually kill you. So what you're doing is you're taking a risk. Now, the question is, I take a risk when I eat sushi, right?
Sure.
I take a risk when I eat a hamburger sandwich that is cooked raw, yeah. I have a risk.
And as you like to point out, when you get in the car, you take a risk.
I take a risk. So I think the answer to this is if you're going to have raw beef, and I don't recommend it. I'm not going to get on the wrong side of this argument. Yeah. I'm going to be politically correct and say never, never, never eat raw beef and make sure that your burgers are cooked through and through and they're not rare.
Yeah.
Now, given the fact that people may not do this, how do you actually cut down your risk? Well, the answer is the way you cut down the risk is you go to a local butcher and you pick out a piece of beef that you want to have, and you have the butcher wash the outside of the piece of beef. So let's say you're going to use ground round, or if you're going to have it, you might as well go to sirloin and you have ground sirloin. They literally wash it and pat it dry. The E. coli are on the outside. They're not in the beef. They're on the outside. You then make sure that they're using it on a totally cleaned beef maker, the contraption that produces ground beef, which is a grinder. You make sure that that's actually been cleaned and washed, and then you put it through there. What happens is when you buy ground beef in a grocery store that's been pre-ground, it's in some company which is outside of the area, and they put in all different cuts of beef, and although they keep it relatively clean, it's really not as clean as you could do it. Or you buy it and you grind it yourself in your house. And that's what I'm going to get you for Christmas. But I have one in my house.
Yeah.
I have one in my house that I got from my grandmother, and it was from making chopped liver. So it goes in a grinder, and I could do that in my house. And you know what? Maybe – I don't think I'll do it. I'm the only one who eats it in the house. It's not going to happen. So anyway, be careful if you're going to eat ground beef, or cut it out, like I'm going to say, politically correct.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we go to a listener in Dallas, Texas. Hi.
Hi. I have been, over the last few years, losing my sense of smell. And I've seen my primary care doctor and an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and they're kind of telling me, it's just that you're getting old. And I'm wondering if I should be more aggressive in looking for additional diagnosis, or if I'm just doomed.
Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 55. I don't feel that old.
That's not that old.
No, 55 is not that old. 55 is the new 20. And it's not that. Tom is smiling and rolling his eyes. I wasn't going to say the new 40. I was going to say the new 20. You might as well go for it. But at 55, you're actually not that old. Certainly to lose a sense of smell. What about your sense of taste? And I don't mean sweet, salty, sugar, or sour.
Right. No, I'm noticing that it's being affected now, especially maybe in the last year. Someone gave me a snack that had a peanut butter flavor, and I could not tell that it tasted like peanut butter.
Okay.
On the bright side, my husband does lots of cooking, and he loves using spices, and I can now tolerate So in other words, have to make a separate batch.
Your sense of smell has improved your marital relationship because he can tolerate that. I absolutely love that. That is great. Well, there are a few things. You went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and what did they say?
He looked up my nose with a flashlight and mm-hmm. said that there weren't any obstructions visible, and he asked if I felt an obstruction when I was breathing, and I said, no, I don't. Everything feels clear. And he had me do a little scratch test where he would give me four choices. Mm-hmm. Does this smell like X, Y, Z?
Okay.
And in each case, I could, if because he gave me the choices, I could tell what they were. If he had not said what they were a couple times, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been able to figure out.
So you could pick it out because you knew the four choices, but otherwise you would not be able to do it. Did he give you any medication for it at all? Any steroid nasal spray?
My primary care doctor had tried that. I did that for a month, and I didn't notice any improvement.
Okay, so you had a steroid, because that's one of the causes, can be a steroid nasal spray. Another one can be polyps in the back of the nose. Another one can be strokes, but you haven't had a stroke. You would know if you had that. Trauma to the brain that destroys the olfactory center within the brain can also produce it. And then there's just the degeneration of the cells within the body, just like some people can't hear as well as the body ages, and some people can't see as well, and other people don't smell as well. Have you seen a neurologist at all to see if there's something neurologically going on?
No, and that's what I wondered, if I should be more aggressive and be trying to get...
Well, the only other question is whether or not there's something going on in the olfactory center inside your brain. That's frankly the only other thing. You've got the receptors in the nose, they're one aspect, and then you've got the brain, which interprets it.
But they can't do anything about it, can
they? No, but that would be the question. But the chances of that happening are pretty remote. I mean, you know, an MRI scan of the brain is going to answer whether or not there's something going on. So what would I do? Okay, in a case like this, I'd get another opinion from another ENT doctor. That's what I would do.
Okay.
And the only reason I would do that is I would say, you know, before I accept this as a final diagnosis, I want to have a concurring diagnosis. Because the chances that something is going on in your brain are really remote. The chances that something is going on in your nose is where it undoubtedly is. And I would just want to make sure, I'd just get a second look to see, is there a polyp or something that's interfering with it? If not, it's unfortunately a case that happens. Now, there are neurological diseases that can present like this. So a question I have is, do you have a tremor at all?
No.
Okay. Because one of the signs of Parkinsonism that can occur is anosmia. In other words, where people lose their sense of smell. It can actually be a sign of Parkinson's that can occur a year or two or 3 years before there's a tremor and other things. And that's why a neurologist may help sort that out. And I had one of my favorite patients who had a lack of smell, and we did a whole workup on it. We never did an MRI of the brain. And then 3 years later, started to develop a tremor, and that's Parkinsonism. And it turns out that's one of the things. So the other thing I might do is I would go to a neurologist and say, is there something neurologically going on, and this is really the marker for that. That would be the other thing. Okay.
Okay.
Good luck, and enjoy your husband's cooking now that you taste delicious to you.
Well, the other thing is the world does seem much cleaner. So there are...
Oh, I love it. Oh, I love it. Thanks. Thanks so much.
We appreciate the call. Thanks. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a question from a longtime listener, Janine. She asks, if you find mold on the surface of food, do you need to dispose of all of that food, or can you simply cut or remove the moldy area?
Well, if you have mold on bread, I would throw the bread out. I mean, it's not going to taste good, and it means it's really totally within the bread. So I never – have you ever eaten moldy bread?
No.
No, I mean, not that
How
I know
How about any
of.
Other? I would throw
well,
away whatever.
But when it comes to things like cheese, there can be mold on cheese. There's some cheeses that have mold that grow on them, and
That's
then you cut off the mold.
Cheese kind of a mold anyway? I mean,
yeah, it is. It's sort of within that range. And so you cut off the mold, and you can have cheese. How about mold on yogurt?
I wouldn't eat it.
So is it bad for you? Well, a lot of mold just doesn't taste good. It means the food is rancid. It may give you a little gastroenteritis, or it may just be yucky to eat. How about if you were – if you were starving in the desert and all you had was moldy bread.
Well, you'd eat anything.
I'd eat moldy bread. Yeah. That would be it. And I'd certainly eat moldy cheese. And if I didn't have a knife, I'd probably eat it with the mold on. So I think I'd stick away from it. But from a cheese point of view, that's different. Because I have cheese that I age in my refrigerator, and I will cut off the mold and then eat the cheese. My daughter, on the other hand, who's a family doc, comes home, because she comes home periodically, and if she sees any mold on any cheese in my refrigerator, that's this old cheddar that I have, she throws it out. No matter what I tell her to do, it doesn't make any difference.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Post it to our Zorba Pastor on your health Facebook page, or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a recipe coming up. Actually, we have some drinks coming up, so you'll want to stick around for that.
Mocktails,
that's right. Lots more of your calls, some more interesting research to kick around, and our medical myth buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. You'll find the line open right now. But before our next call, Zorba, some drinks to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about mocktails.
Mocktails.
How do you like it, Tom?
I love it.
You like it? See, you've got a smile on your face. You haven't even tasted
it. So when we do a salad or something, there'll be chicken salad. Ooh! Anyway, let's do the drinks.
Okay, so mocktails are cocktails without the alcohol.
Yeah.
Now, I am not a teetotaler. I have an alcoholic beverage when I want to, but there are times that I don't want to have an alcoholic beverage at all, and this is a perfect example.
Okay, well, let's
do it. So we're going to do three different mocktails, okay?
Got it.
So get your pencil out.
We have two of them right here.
That's right. So the first mocktail we're going to do is a mock mojito. Mm-hmm. So start out with 4 to 5 sprigs of fresh mint.
Okay, four to five sprigs of fresh
mint.
That's
right. So you're going to have to go down to the fresh mint store and get some sprigs of mint. That's right. One lime.
A lime.
Do not use lime juice. It won't take, reconstituted lime juice does not work.
Right.
A 1 ounce of simple syrup.
An ounce of simple syrup.
It's called simple syrup. Now, you can make simple syrup. You can Google it on the web, or it's in The Joy of Cooking, or you can use something called agave nectar.
Oh, I know about
which
agave.
Is good.
Yeah.
6 to 8 ounces of soda water.
6 to 8 ounces of soda water.
And you're going to garnish it with lime wedges and mint sprigs, okay?
Lime wedges and mint sprigs it is right here.
Okay,
on
so I'm going to give you an instruction. You're going to tell me what does that mean. I bet. Are you ready?
All right.
Muddle the lime.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Muddle the lime. So you need a muddler.
I find myself muddled at times.
Crushed. Yeah. Crushed. That's what you do. You crush that. You do it in, you want to get that lime.
You can't
sort
just
of
do that
there.
With some gizmo handheld.
Well, it is. It's a handheld gizmo.
Oh, it is.
It's a
okay.
muddler. And
I
it costs about 10 bucks.
Yeah.
And I've got one at home. I'm sure you've got one in your house somewhere, right?
Yeah, right.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
Reserve one sprig for the garnish, but basically muddle the lime and with the simple syrup in the bottom of the glass. So basically you're mixing the simple syrup with the lime. Add ice cubes. Okay, add the ice cubes to that. Then squeeze the half of one lime into the glass. You've got to do this in order, by the way. Do it exactly this way. Squeeze half of the lime into the glass, reserving the other half for garnish. You're going to slice it into 3 or 4 wedges. Top it off with soda water. Stir. Drop in the lime wedges and decorate with a sprig of lime. That's it. It's a mojito without the mojito bite.
It's very pretty.
Now, we've got it right here.
It. Very
we're going to drink it, and you're going to say,
here,
cheers. We're gonna
Happy
click.
Holiday.
We're going to click the plastic glasses. Here we go. I love it. It tastes like a mojito without the mojito bite.
Really
you like it?
Yeah, I love it.
Okay, let's do our second mocktail.
Yeah.
Winter Chiller. This one I haven't made. So
Winter Chiller.
Okay. 1 ounce of freshly squeezed orange juice. Notice the citrus, sort of the citrus, if you will, ambiance.
I know freshly squeezed is better. Could you use the other if it has the pulp in it?
Freshly squeezed is better.
Okay,
it's better.
It.
I mean, you could use it, but freshly squeezed, once again, the freshness is important.
Got it.
2 ounces of chilled ginger beer.
2 ounces of chilled ginger beer.
That's right, ginger beer. Once a ginger beer is basically, it's not ginger ale, it has a different taste to it.
Okay.
3 ounces of chilled sparkling apple cider.
3 ounces of chilled sparkling apple cider.
Make sure it's not hard cider, remember. This is a mocktail.
Right. Got it.
Ice. Uh-huh. And 3 frozen cranberries.
3 frozen cranberries.
Yes, you just buy the cranberries, put them in the freezer. Okay, yeah. Instructions. Combine the orange juice, ginger beer, and sparkling cider in a glass. Top with ice. Gently stir to combine and garnish with cranberries. What's a winter chiller?
Yeah.
Okay, are you ready for mocktail number 3?
I am, and we have it right here, too.
Kiwi's Big Adventure. How do you like it?
I love it. Kiwi's,
Big Adventure.
Got it.
Ooh, good. Mocktails, you.
Yeah.
Okay, this makes 2 drinks. Start out with 2 ripe kiwis, mm-hmm. peeled and coarsely chopped.
2 ripe kiwis, peeled and coarsely chopped.
Right. You're going to need a vegetable peeler to peel the top of those kiwis, you know, because it's got that fuzzy stuff on top. 1 medium lime juice. So you're going to juice a medium lime.
Medium lime.
Again.
Juice.
Do not use reconstituted. 4 tablespoonfuls of agave nectar, ice, and cold soda water. Okay, so place the kiwis and lime juice in a blender and process until it's smooth, okay? Then divide the kiwi mixture between 2 tall glasses. You'll use about 1/3 of the cup of puree per drink, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Mix 2 tablespoonfuls of agave nectar with a nice long spoon, because you're going to use a nice long glass. Put ice in and then tap it with seltzer. Gently stir and serve. And this is Kiwi's Big Adventure. You ready? That's it. No, we have to toast.
Okay.
Toast. That's it. Here we are.
They're both good.
Tasty. Very
good. Which one do you
taste.
Like better?
Let's see. Do I like Kiwi's Big Adventure? I like the name Kiwi's Big Adventure.
Well, I don't know.
Better than the Mock Mojito.
They're both really good.
You know, it's hard to say. I like them both.
Yeah.
I like them both. So, and you will love them. I promise. So if you want a copy of today's recipe and all of our other wonderful recipes, come to our website at zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, we are all over Facebook.
Yeah. 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba. And a listener in Springfield, Missouri joins in. Hi.
Hello. How's it going today?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I had a question. I wondered if there was some kind of medical link between corn syrup and migraine headaches. And the reason I ask is when I was younger, I used to get migraines really bad, and nothing I could take would really help, nothing the Tylenol or aspirin. So I started just eliminating stuff from my diet. I kicked out soda and energy drinks, and eventually I kind of limited it down to stuff with corn syrup, even if it was like tea or lemonade. If I would drink that or eat something with it, yeah, I would have... pretty soon thereafter, I have a pretty severe migraine headache. My question was, is there some kind of medical research or a link on how between corn syrup and migraine headaches?
Well, high fructose corn syrup is the most common sweetener used in America. Mm-hmm. And if you believe Michael Pollan, who wrote in his famous book that corn has colonized humans, it's a totally different way of looking at it, because we plant more corn today than we ever did.
It's ridiculous.
And it's ridiculous. Yeah. And high fructose corn syrup is associated with lots of calories, because they are cheap, inexpensive calories, and they find their way into everything.
Yeah.
Now, does high fructose corn syrup cause this more than others? So you've had soda with high fructose corn syrup, and you can eat soda, which has just sucrose, just has regular sugar. Have you tried that to see if there's a difference for you?
I have tried that, and I found if I've tried soda without corn syrup, I don't get the headaches.
And you don't get the headaches. So it may be, first of all, it may be that there is a difference. I'm a great believer. I'm a migraineur. That's the term, a migraineur. I get migraine headaches. I get them more or less. They tend to be more seasonal nowadays than they used to be. And I don't have any food intolerances that cause migraines. And you may have a food intolerance that causes migraines. And they're very specific. For a lot of people, it's peanuts, it's chocolate. It tends to be good foods. Broccoli does not tend to cause migraine headaches. Or do carrots and celery. Now, the other thing is, whatever you're drinking that is manufactured with high fructose corn syrup, because you are eating industrialized food, It's industrialized. It's manufactured. There may be other things in there that are on the label or not on the label. So it's not pure corn syrup. So if you want to know if it's pure corn syrup, I will tell you what to do. Although it's very hard to blind this. The way you would do it is this. Go to the grocery store and get Karo syrup, K-A-R-O. Karo syrup is corn syrup. There's light and there's dark. Get the light Karo syrup. Put it in a glass with some water and make some sweet water. Then just taste it. Don't. This is not where you're actually going to see if it's working. Then take sugar, mix it up around, and make it for the same amount of sweetness. Then have someone else fill up a bunch of cups and a blind taste test. And over the period of the next few days, have some sugar water with corn syrup and have some sugar water with sucrose and see if one actually brings it on. Because don't eat manufactured industrialized food. Plain sugar water. And if one actually consistently brings on your migraine, you'll know it's the high fructose corn syrup. And if it does not consistently, because you can blind the test, you got to have somebody else, does not consistently bring it on, you'll know it's something else in your drink.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. Okay.
Appreciate the call. Thanks. 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a wonderful father-in-law who is 91, and he had, at 79, he had his first hip transplant, did beautifully, and when he was 89, he decided he should get the other one done. Everything went fine, but while he was in the hospital already, he started itching, and I brought up fresh sheets, thinking maybe it was something in the laundry. He's been itching for 2 years. He's in incredibly good health and walks and everything else, but he itches like crazy. He said the only time he doesn't itch is when he's in the shower. We've tried antihistamines, and some made him tired, so we got him the ones that didn't make him tired. And we have tried cortisone creams, even some with prescription. But, of course, you can't put that all over your body.
Yeah. So he itches all over, not just in the hip area.
Yes, yes, yes. He itches, I mean, his back, his arms, everything. You know, that it's pretty miserable. He has an excellent attitude, but it's kind of driving him nuts. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I have seen online has been people who, apparently it's a metal allergy or something, and when the second hip goes in, your body's built up the antibodies and it causes this
maybe that's a big maybe. By the way, you know, what happens is itching is a problem. And if you go online, you go to a website and the website may be filled with garbage and it may be filled with speculation, but it's a website. So you look at it and go, oh, this is the website. This gave me the answer. It is on the web. It doesn't mean it's actually there. And it's a question because obviously it's the first thing I would say. There may be something that he may be allergic to in the metal. On the other hand, things also happen coincidentally. In other words, he went into the hospital. He had a bunch of stuff done. He had a bunch of medications with the surgery. You know, an allergic reaction to one of the medications ought to be better by now. But itching is not an uncommon thing to occur with people, and total body itching can be very, very disturbing. Has he gone to an allergist?
I don't think he has.
He should go to an allergist. He should see whether or not this is a variation of chronic hives. Chronic hives can also produce itching. And sometimes there are other medications that are used to reduce the histamine reaction, not just over-the-counter medicines. But there are other drugs that we actually use for people who have autoimmune diseases and have other problems to do that. So I would recommend a good review of his medications, going to an allergist to see if that's the case. Obviously, you've looked at you know, at whether or not it's through the soaps and others, and you've done your due diligence with that. Another question I have is, how often does he shower?
Probably every day.
I would stop doing that. For 1 month, I would sponge bathe, and I would sponge bathe those areas that get dirty. You know, I would stop all showering because we remove the oils on our skin. It's very important, and that's one very common cause of itching happens to be the oil that's on the skin. I would take Benadryl at bedtime, 50 milligrams, 25 to 50, but I'd try to tolerate 50, and I would take Zyrtec during the day. Zyrtec is one of the antihistamines during the day. And once again, okay. I would not shower. I would use an emollient cream or lotion that's comforting on the skin. No showering, no bathing, 1 month. That's going to be a hard sell for him because he feels better in the shower. So, but if you start with a month, maybe you'll get him to do it for a week. That would be it. But a day doesn't do anything. Believe me, a day is not going to do it. Okay?
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
We can't take that hip back out.
No, you can't. And the reality, he may need another hip. And I'm not convinced he's allergic to the hip. I'm not convinced about that. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a question from a concerned listener, Brenda. She asks, oftentimes after I exercise, usually after my morning swim, I experience an acute pins and needles sensation in my body. This feeling occurs mostly in my back. I'm overall a healthy person who gets plenty of exercise. What causes this feeling, and is it something I should be concerned about?
Well, people have different feelings after they exercise. They sweat. They've had lots of adrenaline going through their body. They've built up certain lactic acid within the muscles. Maybe all of these things. I don't think it's anything to be concerned about. If it bothers you, what I would do is I would look at hydration to see whether or not hydration was an issue. And then I would look at hydrating afterwards. Some people, when they have funny sensations in their skin afterwards, go and take a shower. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that we often feel good after a shower. After we exercise, we have these sensations on our skin. And I think this is a variation on that.
Have a potentially prickly question for Zorba? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
An interesting topic to talk about that's coming up next. Some more of your calls, our medical myth buster. Don't go away. Stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we talk about exercise and creativity.
Right. Very, very interesting. And as you know, we talk about exercise all the time.
Yeah.
Sitting is the new smoking. You know, that's a concept that when you sit around too much,
it's not as bad as smoking.
No,
cigarettes.
But it's just a way of sort of looking and visualizing that. Yeah. So this is another very interesting article about exercise and how it improved cognitive behavior of thinking. So we have two kinds of thinking, creative thinking. We have divergent and convergent, and one is really, divergent thinking is thinking of multiple solutions for one problem, whereas convergent thinking is zeroing in, and this is the answer to the problem. And both of those lead to creativity, thinking of lots of possibilities and then zeroing in and saying, but I think this possibility is a good idea. So they're both important.
Thinking it through, how would it work if we did it this way and what would happen?
Right, and what are the possibilities of how do you make it work? Let's think of all the total universe.
Got it.
And then once you think of that is how do you actually do that? And this is involved in creativity. So researchers took athletes. Okay, these are athletes who exercise four times a week. And they looked at non-athletes. Okay, they took roughly 50 of athletes, 50 non-athletes. And then they had them do a creativity test. So these are tests which looked at the first part of the test. They had to think of alternative uses for a pen. Okay. What are other things you can do with a pen and write them down?
Okay. Yeah.
And then the participants were presented with a series of three words and asked to find a link with them that connected them for an instant. So long connected to like the word time and hair might connect to the word stretch. Mm-hmm. And then they look at how long it took people to actually do it. And they found, for instance, that the people who exercised were able to do it better than the people who didn't exercise. So you might look at this thing and say, well, athletes are different. they're going to think about this differently. But they controlled for age. They controlled for occupation, you know, whether they were students or non-students. They didn't give them an IQ test. But when they looked at it, they said, we see a trend here. We see the people who exercise appear to have the ability to actually look at these convergent and divergent thinking more faster and in a more creative way than the people who didn't.
That's interesting. Does it matter what kind of exercise?
Well, it didn't seem to. In this particular study, they just looked at people who hit the treadmill. They may run, they might jog, they may work out, they might play tennis. But they did something 4 days a week, and they did something on a regular basis.
I can't think of a whole lot of other things to do with a pen.
Well, no, that's right. But you're sitting here, Tom.
I guess I'm not getting enough exercise.
You are not exercising. Yeah. But I think, once again, it shows that exercise really does affect the brain. We know that exercise is good for the body. We know that people who exercise feel better. And maybe just because you feel better, you can come up with more creative ideas.
1-800-462-7413 is our telephone number. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, time for today's Mythbuster. It comes from a listener we'll call Barry. He writes, for years, I have not exercised in the evening, as I've heard from several sources that I may not be able to fall asleep as easily or that my sleep will be disrupted. I'm in my 50s, and I do get plenty of sleep. I feel that exercise is so very essential to my health that I would rather work out lightly in the evening as opposed to watching TV or reading than worry about lack of sleep. I've heard you shouldn't exercise before bed, but this happens to be the most convenient time for me. Is this, in fact, true?
The fact is, exercise any time of the day is good. It doesn't matter if it's when you wake up in the morning, before you go to sleep at night. Some people find they get more energy at nighttime, so they have trouble going to sleep. And other people say, you know, I work out, and then it's great. I'm tired, and I can finally go to sleep. So I think it's what works out for you. I am not a morning exerciser myself. Every time if I try to get up in the morning to exercise, I find I have an excuse, and I don't
I'm the opposite. If I don't exercise in the morning, forget it.
So you get up in the morning and exercise.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the morning.
Yeah.
See, and I don't exercise in the morning. I'm more of an afternoon, evening exerciser.
Yeah.
But you're a morning person.
What
time do you exercise in the morning?
Well, I don't know. When I get up and have a quick breakfast and go over, I don't know, 7, 7.30.
See, now, I would never do that. I would never get up electively, have breakfast, and then go and exercise. That would be, I would get up. I don't have breakfast, first of all, but I would never do that in the morning. But in the evening, come 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, I'm ready to hit the treadmill. That's not for you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So you would never do that. You'd never leave and go at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the answer is exercise at any time is good exercise, and it doesn't matter when you do it.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to take a stab at? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org, or you can do it on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Back to the phone, Zorba, and a listener in Friendswood, Texas. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
We are house hunting, and there is a house that we like, that we're thinking about purchasing. I noticed that there is a field of power lines that run behind the house. It's actually sandwiched between two subdivisions. And I went and talked to the power company. He told me that those lines are high voltage transmission lines that go a long way, running several miles. So I live on the internet, and, you know, I've read up on electromagnetic fields, and there have been some talk about people worrying about it causing cancer, particularly childhood leukemia. But what I gather is that the link is weak to prove that, and, you know, or inconclusive, I guess. So I was just wondering what Dr. Zorber's idea was about living in areas where you have these power lines that are running straight through neighborhoods and stuff like that, above ground, not necessarily underground.
And Zorba, I can guarantee that whatever your answer is to this, you will hear from other listeners.
Oh, of course. Of course I will hear. You know, it's I find a very interesting issue, and it turns out that one of my patients is one of the country's experts on high voltage lines and whether or not it affects milk production. That's a big thing in Wisconsin. That's where it started. He goes all over the country talking about it. He's a high voltage expert, an engineer who initially, this is sort of his second job in life. He initially was just an electrical engineer, had an interest in it, and then did a lot of research. The scientific research that is well-based does not show that there's any evidence that this causes childhood leukemia and other things. There's no evidence of that. Now, there's a huge group out there that does not believe this research. One part of that group are lawyers. And they're very supportive of this because they go and they sue electrical companies, and sometimes they win. They lose, I don't know, two or three out of four suits, but one out of four suits they win. So there's a monetary issue. You always have to question that. The other thing is anyone can put up a website. If you go to oneplusone.com, you can get a website with a little a template on the website for about $5 a month. So you can put a high-voltage website up there, and that may, you know, you can state whatever you want to state. But as you said, the scientific evidence is outrageously weak. It doesn't really show anything there. Now, could there be something there? Well, my thought is if you're worried about it, you don't live in that area, you know, if that's what it is. If it's something that really concerns you, then you don't live in the area. But if you look at people, for instance, in urban areas that live near highways, the air pollution near highways, there's a good link there. Nobody discusses that. They're worried about high-voltage wires, but what about the carbon monoxide coming out of cars? Because you happen to live on a busy street in the middle of the city of Chicago. You know, that's good. We know that that air pollution causes problems and environmental issues. So I think this is a very minor issue. That's what I think. But people are, they're religious about it. There's a fervor out there about how high voltage causes many, many problems. And I just want to go back to the fact that this is an old problem, that when radio first came out and they started broadcasting, there was a hue and cry on these waves are going out to all of us and they're going to destroy us. And people were quite worried about getting leukemia and other things from radio waves back in the 1920s and 1930s. And there's no evidence, of course, that it does so. Good luck to you, and send us a photo of the house if you buy it.
I sure will. Thank you so much. Yeah. I love your laugh.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. Again, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener with us in Traverse City, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, guys.
How can we help?
My husband and I are weekly listeners, and we love your healthy tips and humorous banter, especially.
Well, thank you so
much. Thank you
very much. Thank you.
So my problem is I'm biting my tongue and my cheek while I sleep. This started about 2 months ago, and now it's been happening like every 10 nights or so. Mm. It's always on my left side of my mouth, and the sleeping position doesn't seem to be a factor. I've tried, you know, both sides and my back, my stomach, and I seem to bite my tongue or my cheek in any of those positions.
Mm-hmm. I bet I know what Zorba's going to say, but
no,
I'm going to listen.
No, please, please, yeah. Please. No. But if you know what I'm going to say, I mean, that takes away the fun. So go ahead, give the advice.
Well, you're going to say that she bit it the first time and that these reoccurrences are because of the irritation that's there.
Well, that certainly could be a possibility. So was that part of it? Is that what happened?
I don't think so. I don't feel any swelling. Right,
well, who knows better, you or Zorba or me?
Sorry about that, Tom, but I don't feel any swelling, and my cheek is totally healed. So,
see, bummer. Any dental work recently? Any work that you've had done in your mouth?
No, I haven't had any dental work.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any TMJ pain in your jaw when you bite into things like apples?
I do not.
Uh-huh. You know, this has gone on for how long?
Just about a couple months. Uh-huh. The first time it occurred, I had had a stressful trip, and I remember taking half of an Ambien to help me sleep that evening. Mm-hmm. And I blamed it on that. And then after that, I thought I'll be fine because I don't ever take Ambien. And then the second time it happened, I thought, whoa, and now it's just happening periodically.
Right, right. And those things, I mean, things like that bruxism, which is this clenching of the teeth, can happen over and over again. I've got a couple of recommendations. Sometimes I think we get into, if you will, a habit of doing this. We may start out with, as you said, with a stressful event, and then we're in bed and we just sort of, you know, our brains are working one way, we're sleeping another way, and we're sort of reliving not the stressful event, but how we responded to the stressful event. So I have a suggestion that for 2 to 4 weeks that you actually try a medication called gabapentin. You'd have to get it from your doctor. It's a prescription-only drug, 300 milligrams at bedtime. It changes the architecture of sleep, and that's how it works. It's a commonly used medication that's given for chronic pain, pain disorders that are neuropathic in nature, and it often restores sleep for people, and it becomes a little bit more normative. And I think what you actually have is more of a sleep problem than a dental problem. I think Tom's idea was great. You had an irritation. That might have really started it. But when the irritation goes away, and if the irritation didn't start it, then we have to look at something else. And I think we should look primarily at sleep. I think that's what I would try.
I'll give it a shot.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you so much for listening. And thanks for those very kind comments that you made.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-800-462-7413. It is, of course, toll-free. 1-800-462-7413. And before we head out, Zorba, it's time again to hear from your favorite crew, the Grammar Police.
Woohoo!
This week's Grammar Police email comes all the way from Chiang Mai, Thailand, where Lamar takes issue with your pronunciation of one of your favorite spicy sauces. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, it's always great to hear you mention..."
I know what sauce he's talking about.
What is it?
Sriracha.
Very good. The name, you say sriracha, is pronounced like Sri Lanka, with the accent on the first syllable, with a rising tone like asking a question. Sri means honor, glory, fame, and racha refers to a king or monarch. Sri Racha, indeed a monarch of a sauce and worthy of its fame. In closing, your common sense approach to health is a real gift to the world. Thank you.
Oh, that's so sweet. So it's Sri Racha.
Except up on the
Sri Racha. Racha.
No, Sri Racha.
Sri Racha. Sri Racha.
Yeah.
Sri Racha. We got a song here somewhere. Sri Racha.
I'm 99% of the people say it the way you do, or a lot of people do, I think.
Yeah, but we live in Wisconsin. We don't live in Thailand, and it's a Thai sauce.
If you,
I mean, how many Thai words do you know?
Now,
I know one, Sawadi.
Well, now I know one.
Thank you for something. Hello. Yeah.
If you think Zorba's grammar ain't so hot, send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaBastard.org or go through Facebook.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1221Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.